Iran says it's seriously following up the case of U.S. assassination of General Soleimani and won't let those behind it go unpunished. Lebanon's Hezbollah dismisses Israeli threats to target its missile production facilities, saying the group has the capability to strike anywhere in Israel. China calls on the U.S. to stop using the Hong Kong issue to interfere in its domestic affairs. This following Washington's reaction to the trial of a group of fugitive Hong Kongers. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Starting with Iran, the country saying that it will not let those behind the assassination of top General Soleimani go unpunished. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that Tehran is seriously following up the case of General Soleimani's assassination through legal and diplomatic channels. He underlined the role of the martyr general in fighting terrorism and establishing security and peace in the region. Khatibzadeh says that Soleimani was a pillar of regional balance who sacrificed his life in the fight against extremism. General Soleimani was assassinated in January by the U.S. during a visit to Iraq. Young members of resistance movements from all over the world have got together in the Iranian city of Qom ahead of the first anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination. Let's now go to the city of Qom. Our correspondent Houman Abedi is there. Houman, what's going on there?
Behruz, today a ceremony was held here in the city of Qom to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, who were killed by the U.S. A group of scholars, thinkers, activists, and those who support the resistance movement gathered over here to show solidarity with the cause of these two martyrs. I was talking to some of them. They were from different countries, as earlier I mentioned. They were from Syria, Lebanon, Bahrain, Brazil, Argentina, India, and some other countries. And they were talking to me, telling that we are here to show that by killing the commander of a movement, they cannot stop the move of this, stop this movement, and the youth will, continue the path. The keynote speaker of this ceremony was the head of Iran seminaries and also the head of a front called Resistance Youth Front, which is formed in Iran, and its members are youth from Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and some other countries. These youth want to tell the world that General Qasem Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten. In this event also a message from some officials from Lebanon's Hezbollah was played, and they are going to have some video conference with some of them as well. Right now, the person who is speaking over here is Ayatollah Arafi, who is the head of this front and also the head of all seminaries across Iran. Behruz.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Houman Abedi, our correspondent there, live in the Iranian city of Qom. Now moving on, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that Israel's efforts to prevent the group from obtaining precision-guided missiles have failed. Citizen Nasrallah says that Hezbollah has twice as many precision-guided missiles as it had a year ago. He dismissed the Israeli threats to target a Hezbollah facility in the eastern Bekaa region. Nasrallah warned that the resistance movement is capable of hitting any location in Israel in retaliation. Hezbollah Secretary General made those comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al Mayadeen television. A political commentator, Hadi El Kawaisi, says that Said Hassan Nasrallah's statement about Hezbollah's missile power has nullified the Israeli regime's claims of stopping the movement's missile program.
I think this statement from Said Hassan changed the game between Lebanon and the Zionist state, because the Zionists said that we are making a battle between the wars to stop the fueling or the build-up of the guided missiles, precise guided missiles to Lebanon from 5 years till now. And they told their people in Israel that they succeeded in this operation. And they said also that the precise guided missiles in the hands of Hezbollah it are imminent threat and a strategic threat for the Israeli state. So today we have a new reality in the struggle or in the battle between Lebanon and Israel. We have a new reality that Lebanon possess this a large number of guided missiles, and he making a new statement of deterrence against Israel. And now we are waiting for the commentators or the policymakers in Israel to wait what will say about this new reality.
Time now for the news review section. Stay with us. Now, China has once again called on the United States to stop using the Hong Kong issue to interfere in its domestic affairs. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian says that Beijing is firmly opposed to any remarks by Washington that disregard facts. He was reacting to a statement from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing that called for the release of a dozen Hong Kongers on trial in the city of Shenzhen. The statement said that their crime was to, quote, flee tyranny. Hong Kong has become another contentious issue between China and the U.S., whose relations were already strained over trade, Taiwan, and the South China Sea, among others. Washington has imposed sanctions on several current and former Hong Kong officials over security law. China has long blamed the U.S. for stoking tensions in Hong Kong by siding with anti-government protesters there. Now, we'll have a couple of people joining me to discuss it a little bit. Our own correspondent in Beijing, Stephen Ribe, and also Fabrizio Goldoni, who's an analyst and commentator, joining us out of Hong Kong. Now, let's go to Beijing first. Stephen, this is going on, another move by the U.S., and then regarding this release of these Hong Kongers, and then we have China again emphasizing this is interference in its internal affairs. Tell us more about it.
Well, we've heard what the Western politicians are saying. They're saying this is a betrayal of the one country, two systems agreement made over Hong Kong, and political repression that violates human rights or those seeking to flee tyranny. I think a more nuanced interpretation is that Hong Kong's own older laws are now being aggressively enforced with the aim of pursuing the spirit and intention of the new national security law. The case of the 12 being tried in Shenzhen is a little bit different because it's actually Chinese law being applied. They are being prosecuted for illegally crossing a border or facilitating this crime being committed by other people. Right, okay, I'm from Beijing, so I can give you the view from here as opposed to what the Western media is saying. I was in the foreign ministry recently, and they said of the CIA and its proxies or just American general, they will never give up. They will wait for years or decades until your guard is down and there is a chink in your armor, and then they will pursue their agenda of subversion. As China sees it, the US is very good at playing a double game. You see, what it does is it funds subversive groups, in the case of Hong Kong, the National Endowment for Democracy or Joshua Wong or whomever. And if those groups succeed with American help, your government is undermined, maybe it even collapses. But if you crack down, yeah, they will also succeed, because then they will be able to label you as tyrannical oppressors, and they will seek to mobilize international, or at least domestic opinion, for hostile action, for a hostile agenda against you. And of course, the Western media obediently joins in. They don't take a nuanced look at what's going on here. They just join in the politicians' chorus of that, you know, there are freedom lovers seeking to flee tyranny, right?
Okay.
You see, what's going on now is that China is deeply suspicious, yeah? This suspicion of China is getting more and more paranoid, to be quite frank. that America is now pursuing an out-and-out hostile, subversive agenda against it. And one pawn, a new pawn in this game that America is playing to undermine, to bring China down, is Hong Kong. I think two groups will suffer as a result of this. One, I think, is the well-intentioned political activists. Yeah, there are many in Hong Kong seeking to preserve Hong Kong's guaranteed freedoms. China sees them as useful idiots. It sees them as unwitting foot soldiers in America's subversive agenda. The other, so it will crack down on them, which is what we're seeing, which is a deep shame, because I think there are many Hong Kongers who really are well-intentioned. I mean, you know, Joshua Wong, for example, his motives are questionable. He's been to America. He's met with the hawkish American senators, including Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz. But I think opposed to him, there are some Hong Kongers who are very well-intentioned, and they are going to be victims. Mm-hmm. The other group of victims is going to be journalists. I think a lot of them are well-intentioned, too. In my opinion, actually, I would say 90% of journalists in China now don't understand China, and they don't understand its concerns here. They believe the propaganda, basically, that they're there to further. They will be cracked down on. China will increasingly see them as agents of the U.S., there to mobilize global or at least domestic public opinion against them to carry out this hostile agenda. So it's just going to get worse and worse, because China's just seeing journalists paranoid. It thinks that all Western journalists are out to get it now. And people like me, it's going to be harder and harder for us to do, because they're deeply suspicious of foreign journalists now.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, let's go to Hong Kong. Fabrizio, this has been going on. I mean, tense relations and threatening each other, and China promising to reciprocate U.S. action has been going on over a host of issues, major ones being Taiwan, South China Sea, military maneuvers there, sale of arms to Taiwan, Hong Kong issue, trade dispute, and you name it. So do you expect any change for the better or for worse under a new administration of the White House soon?
I can say is my opinion is quite difficult to comment, because if we take in consideration the plan Pivot to Asia, started many years ago under the democratic democratic rule. Is not something that has been introduced in the last fourth year of a Trump administration. So I do see something that is coming from far away, and if I can say something about what's happening now about these 12 people, I can see that basically the Western media tell very little about this story. Actually, they don't specify that these people were in basically in China water. Basically, they have been charged for illegal immigration. That is just a 1 year charge. But two of them, they are charged for organizing the trip. And we know, and we want to understand which organization is behind, and we're going to finance these continuously help to people to escape and to jump the bail. The case is quite big, because these people actually were in the court. They have been granted the bail, and they jump in the bail and they escape. So it's not a small thing. You know. I want to add another thing, so that if you put in perspective, this is not an isolated case. You know, just the 2nd of December, there were 155 lawmakers, mostly from U.S., Britain, Germany, and Japan, asking for international call with several points for saving these people and these kind of things. Not only this one. In these days, there are representatives from Britain, France, Australia, Germany, Netherlands, that are physically in Yantian, okay, where the people court, is there for celebrating the process, and they are doing demonstrating outside, in a form of an interference that, in my opinion, is reaching the level of that is quite ridiculous, quite absurd.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much for your comments, Stephen Ribe, our correspondent, joining me from Beijing, and Fabrizio Goldoni, analyst and commentator from Hong Kong. And that's the end of this news review. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed a $2.3 trillion bill, including a $900 billion COVID relief package, into law, and that after days of stalling and criticizing the legislation. The signing averts a Tuesday government shutdown and restores unemployment benefits to millions of Americans. It clears the way for $600 stimulus checks as well. The Senate and the House passed the bill last week, but Trump described it as wasteful and unnecessary. The president threatened he would not sign unless the individual relief checks are tripled in amount. House Democrats, who have long favored $2,000 payments to struggling Americans, are to hold a vote on the proposal on Monday. The measure is expected to fail, as many Republicans are opposed to it. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic, with over 19.1 million cases and 330,000 fatalities. Washington, D.C., correspondent Colin Campbell says the government's $600 stimulus checks aren't sufficient for the people in need, but the checks can at least postpone the eviction process for many Americans.
It only provides $600 for those who are in need. Think about that. If you are paying a mortgage, rent, you need food, that's already burned up within the first half of the month, never mind a full month of needing additional money to pay off bills. But it also postpones the eviction process for many people as well. There are a lot of things in this bill that the president said he disagreed with, but then there are a lot of reasons why he should have signed it. Will Congress take up another measure to provide additional aid for Americans who really need it? Everybody is in agreement that $600 is not much, but it's still more than $0. And I think that's the overall point that members of Congress were trying to make to the president when he was reluctant to sign the bill. Now, there are those who believe that the president initially rejected it and wanted to call for more money to seem as more of a populist, to seem that he was fighting for the American people. However, there were those who disagreed with the president's process in doing all this, especially in light of more than 300,000 Americans dying to COVID-19. Remember, a virus that the president initially called a hoax, one that he was very slow to react to and respond to. So many believe that, hey, if the president had acted a lot sooner, more lives would have been saved. So if he really was acting in the interests of American people, he would have been more responsive and quicker acting when it came to COVID-19.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hi everyone, this is John. This is another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect all stakeholders in the region, which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's move ahead and try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we will discuss the investment projects by Saudi Arabia in the Maldives. And we shall also look at how warming ties between India and Taiwan has angered China.
Maldives is in a social and economic crisis and naturally seeks to make the best use of every opportunity from its strategic geopolitical place, which is key to maritime security in the Indian Ocean. Neighboring India and the Asian giant China have for long been jostling for influence in the island nation, but Saudi Arabia is now upping its game.
Saudi Arabia has some big plans for the Maldives and once and again announces a fat investment project, loan or donation to the country. Members of the Saudi royal family regularly visit and hold extravagant parties there.
In the case of the Saudis, this is about the projection of soft power. The Maldives is an island that's been in incredible economic difficulties the past few years. It's a Muslim majority island and set of islands, and the Saudis see an opportunity both to leverage influence, to gain from investments. There's a burgeoning tourist industry, there's a fisheries industry. It's in a very strategically important place, location in South Asia. But it's also about leveraging influence with the international Ummah, the Muslim community. And so the Saudis, on the back of this cash, are investing in mosques, as they do all over the world. And the imams who will be in charge of giving the sermons in these mosques have to come with the Saudi stamp of approval, which means they will have to follow the Wahhabist sectarian, ineffably literalist line of Islam, which the Saudi state is underpinned by. And so it's a win-win for the Saudis. They gain influence, they gain revenue from these investments bear fruition in terms of what the return is. But I think most importantly, it's about gaining and securing and cementing more influence with the international Islamic community.
Saudi Arabia's royal family purportedly plans to invest over $10 billion for a French Riviera-style township in Farfu. Touted to be the next Dubai, the microstate-like high-class resort area is projected to be teeming with many flamboyant residential and tourist facilities with numerous hotels, malls and airports. Often called the last paradise on earth, Maldives attracts tens of thousands of tourists every year. The island nation has over 20 island clusters, but most of the population live in a few of them because the government does not have the necessary resources to provide the basic facilities and services such as drinkable water, healthcare, or schools.
I think everybody thought that Maldives are perfection, a paradise. And they are, but not on every island. And there is this local people, they're so poor, they have kitchens outside, they sleep outside, their walls are mostly broken. There is actually a huge gap between rich people and poor people.
The inhabitants of some of these atolls, especially the least populated or underdeveloped ones, welcome and want the investment and infrastructure it brings, but fear that the Saudis manage to buy their entire home islands.
Well, as I say, it's a very strategically vital place. It's close to India. China's got a significant investment in the Maldives. And so the Saudis, I think, under Prince Bin Salman, are following a very ambitious geopolitical project. They want to project soft power around the world rather than just within their own region. Bin Salman has the architect of this Vision 2030 project by which to modernize Saudi Arabia, to burnish its image on the world stage of holding huge and big sporting events, boxing, football, wrestling and so forth. So it's like Bin Salman decided that it's time Saudi Arabia came out
from the cold, so to speak. It wants to move away from just being an oil-rich country. It wants to invest and diversify. And an economic policy, which extends out with your own borders, also carries with it a geopolitical context. And as I say, the Saudis are ambitious under Bin Salman, or Bin Salman's personally very ambitious for Saudi Arabia. And this is why we're seeing all this activity. He's seen the success of Dubai for the United Arab Emirates, and he wants a slice of that pie. He understands that Western consumers, the tourist industry, and all these things is the way to go in order to diversify away from just being a one commodity economy.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have global media footage in this regard. So let's see how they have covered the issue of Maldives, and then we can move on.
Saudi Arabia is reportedly looking to effectively purchase, via a 99-year lease, a Maldivian atoll, the Farfu Atoll specifically, currently a Maldivian administrative division. The sale is speculated to involve a forced relocation of the 4,000-some people currently living there. The Saudis would then develop the atoll, presumably exploring revenue-generating projects in tourism and even maritime commerce. The sheer scale of the project puts Saudi Arabia in a sound position to secure sovereign territory of the Maldives. In a leaked audio clip aired by a television channel in 2017, Ahmed Nihan, an MP of the ruling Progressive Party of Maldives and the parliamentary majority leader, revealed that the constitution was amended in 2015 at the Saudi royal family's behest to allow them to get a foothold in the country. Commenting on the Saudi interest in the Maldives, foreign policy experts have cited the oil-rich country's intention to secure oil trade routes to East Asia.
Some Maldivians, mostly from smaller atolls, say that Saudis want to buy their islands and force them to live in small condos. They say that Saudi Arabia has already invested to build such settlements on the artificial islands. Former President Abdullah Yameen defended the investment by fellow Muslim country Saudi Arabia for all of the immediate benefits, more money, more jobs, and a better living standard, and rejected any environmental or social risks.
The rumors of trading islands for money or political power have always been frightening for the inhabitants and denied by authorities. But people feel threatened when the government tries to make selling islands easier. Back in 2015, then-President Abdullah Yameen pushed to change the country's law to make it possible for foreigners who invest more than $1 billion to own land in perpetuity. He pitched the idea as a way to bring in more investment. In 2017, reports of a proposed Saudi-funded investment on an atoll in the Maldives, billed as a high-end tourism project, had also been criticized by the opposition, which it said amounted to creeping colonialism by the Saudi government. The Maldives government, however, has refuted these allegations, saying no land has been sold. Without the infrastructure that can be built with the Saudi money, people from the smaller islands may eventually have to leave for the capital or other bigger atolls. But along with the Saudi money comes its puritanical Wahhabi ideas. Saudi-sponsored mosques and madrasas have been the means to make Maldives occupy an ignominious place as one of the largest contributors on a per capita basis of foreign fighters to Daesh Takfiri terrorists.
There's an absolute correlation, there's a causation. The Wahhabi ideology is indistinguishable from that which underpinned ISIS and the other Salafi jihadi groups who have been causing havoc across the Middle East in recent years. The only thing is that the Wahhabi ideology comes with the backing of an entire state. It underpins the state. And so there is absolutely a causation, correlation, call it what you will. Saudi Arabia is the classic archetypal Janus-faced state. It speaks one way to the West in terms of gaining favour with the West, in terms of cementing its alliances with the West in order to project a stronger image and more status than it would otherwise enjoy in the Middle East, given the nature of the state, given its very weak foundations as a singular state. But to the Wahhabi fanatics, it talks another language. It talks the language of jihadism, sectarianism, Takfiri and punishing infidels. The savagery is sometimes exposed, i.e. the murder by bonesaw of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018 in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the multiple beheadings that take place, crucifixions, the extreme and inordinate medieval punishments that are meted out to, in the main, poor migrant workers in Saudi Arabia. And the fact that the West continues to cling, to suck on the teat of Saudi largesse, Saudi money, in order to gain favour when it comes to selling them weapons, selling them services, selling them military training, is just utterly, utterly despicable. But that's the world we live in, and the Saudis are benefiting from the greed that underpins so-called Western civilization.
People have also voiced their opinions on social media, so let's see how they see this situation.
Abdullah Shahid, the foreign minister of Maldives, by posting a picture of him meeting Faisal bin Farhan, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, refers to the alliance between the Maldives and Saudi Arabia. Subramanian Swamy, the former Union Cabinet Minister of India, refers to the independence of the Maldives and emphasizes the right of choice for this country. Niaz Yusuf also mentions the death of Yasser Yahya Saleh, a Yemeni political prisoner in Maldivian prison, and believes the Maldivian government wants to please the Saudis by such actions. This tweet believes that the Saudi investment in the Maldives has appeased this country against Saudi atrocities in Yemen, and that's why the Maldivian government has not taken a critical stance towards them.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Recently, there's been a hot exchange of comments and guise threats among Indian and Chinese officials, as well as netizens of the two countries over Taiwan. The frenzy was apparently caused by a series of pro-Taiwan propaganda on Indian media, but the gesture is widely seen as a result of heightened border tensions between India and China in the Himalayas that left 20 Indian soldiers dead a few months ago.
This round of the India-China brawl was started when members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party and some other Indian internet users shared messages of support for Taiwan during the October 10th holiday, which the Taiwanese celebrate as the anniversary of the foundation of their country. For instance, Y. Satya Kumar, the national secretary of the BJP, tweeted that India stands in solidarity with the courage, strength, and resolve of the Taiwanese people against colonialism and oppression by the imperial power. The messages came as a shock to China, whose embassy in New Delhi had put a lot of efforts to prevent such publicity. The embassy had sent a letter to media friends asking not to refer to Taiwan as a country. They reiterated via all their platforms that Taiwan was an inalienable part of China and expressed strong opposition to any actions that suggested Taiwanese independence. Several BJP officials rebuffed the letter, taunting that the media is not censored in India.
India and China's rivalry is replete with border disputes, but intertwined with billions of dollars of trade cooperation and very well calibrated, as both of them play by the rules of the game more than often. Yet, when one of them raises the game and plays a foolhardy act, the other reciprocates with another precarious reaction. If India plays the Taiwan card, China threatens with the Kashmir card.
In response to Beijing's protestations and embassy's letters, Tajinder Pal Singh Bagga, a spokesman for the BJP in Delhi, printed hundreds of posters wishing Taiwan Happy National Day and posted them on streets around the Chinese embassy building, raising the furor in China. However, the flags were brought down within a few hours, and an official of the New Delhi Municipal Council announced that the move was not authorized. Then China's state-run English-language paper Global Times published an article quoting analysts that the posters hung outside the embassy will only exasperate already soured China-India ties. The piece called on India's ruling party to give up its irrational behavior and to realize it is playing with fire. This is a serious issue for China, as Beijing regularly condemns any insinuation that self-ruled Taiwan is an independent country and insists it must return to the mainland fold by force if necessary. India says it officially follows the One China policy, which means that it doesn't have diplomatic ties with Taiwan. However, both sides have trade offices, which operate as de facto embassies.
For more analysis, we are now joined by Mr. Andrew Leung, who is an independent political analyst. Mr. Leung, welcome to the subcontinent. So, why do you think India is boosting relations with Taiwan?
First of all, a massive free trade area framework has been signed by China and 14 other Southeast Asian nations, the so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is the largest free trade area agreement in the world. But India has chosen to opt out because India cannot afford the kind of free, tariff-free imports from China. Simply, there's no way that the Indian manufacturers or industries can compete. But staying outside the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership places India at a disadvantage because all these that area, all the nations abolishing tariffs amongst themselves, and India exports could well be marginalized. And that's why India is now cozying up to Taiwan, because Taiwan, being not a country, cannot join the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So likewise, Taiwan is increasingly being marginalized as well. So that's the point number one in terms of trade and economics, why India needs to find a partnership in Taiwan. Now, the second dimension is geopolitics, because in the kind of pushback against China, the United States is, of course, using Taiwan as an unsinkable aircraft carrier. And then with the Indo-Pacific kind of strategy, including India, Japan, United States, Australia, the so-called Quad, the India could also make use of Taiwan as a kind of outpost to push back against China as well. So there are two dimensions why India is doing that in relation to Taiwan.
Okay, so you're saying that there are two aspects to it, trade and geopolitics. So how would China react?
Well, I think forming economic relations with Taiwan, it cannot be resisted by Beijing on the grounds of the One China policy, because Taiwan is a separate has a separate economy. But then the countries like India and other countries doing business with Taiwan, they do not necessarily have to recognize Taiwan as an independent country. So in that perspective, there is no contradiction with the so-called One China principle. But on the other hand, of course, Taiwan is now being increasingly marginalized in terms of diplomatic recognition. And Taiwan is, of course, is not recognized by the United Nations as a separate political entity. So I think that from that point of view, China will not react very angrily. And then if you look at that, you know, so what sort of stuff can India sell to Taiwan, or to what extent Taiwan can make use of India this, I think that this, the bark is worse, is not as worse than this fight. I don't think China would be unduly worried. China would force warn countries trying to break the so-called One China principle. But I don't think China would be, would go to full length in stopping trade or economic relationship with Taiwan without breaking the One China policy.
Now, Mr. Leung, before asking the next question, let's see the media views regarding this problem.
Support is growing within India's government to formally start talks on a trade deal with Taiwan, as both democracies see relations with China deteriorate. Taiwan has sought trade talks with India for several years, but Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government has been reluctant to move ahead because it would involve a messy fight with China once any pact is registered at the World Trade Organization. In 2018, India and Taiwan signed an updated bilateral investment treaty. Trade has grown substantially from $1 billion in 2000 to $7.5 billion in 2019. According to Reuters, three top Taiwan firms, Foxconn Technology Group, Wistron Group and Pegatron Corp, all of them top contract manufacturers of Apple, were approved for investment plans of up to $900 million, roughly 6,630 crores, in India in the next 5 years. Indian public sentiment toward China has fallen in the wake of deadly border clashes between the two neighbors starting in May. Modi's government has since banned dozens of Chinese apps, including TikTok, while also speaking with Japan, Australia, and the US about creating alternative supply chains to diversify away from China in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. India has seen more than 7.5 million infections and 115,000 deaths from COVID-19.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Leung, and thank you to the audience for staying with us as well. So, Mr. Leung, you earlier said that China will not react very angrily to this. We've seen the same kind of move by the United States. What is in it for Washington?
I think that Washington is using Taiwan as a political, geopolitical ploy quite effectively. Under the cover of the so-called One China policy, officially, the United States hasn't abandoned the One China policy, but is pushing the envelope here, there, and everywhere. For example, sending high-level officials to Taiwan, and also selling arms, and more recently, quite modern and quite cutting-edge kind of armory, in order to foster Taiwan's defenses against any perceived Chinese aggression. So I think that for the United States, the relationship with Taiwan is also governed by the Taiwan Relations Act, which was in place for many years already. And under the Taiwan Relations Act, and the United States can and sell arms to Taiwan and also boost the kind of defenses of Taiwan and also establishing some kind of relationship without formally recognizing Taiwan as a separate country.
Thank you, Mr. Leung, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. Now, yours. People have also reacted on cyberspace and social media regarding this problem, so let's just take a look.
On the National Day of Taiwan, Satya Kumar, the National Secretary of BJP, congratulated this day and expressed solidarity with the Taiwanese against China. On the other hand, Tsai Ing-wen, the President of Taiwan, also congratulated Diwali to Indians for showing Taiwan solidarity with India, which faced positive feedback from the Indians. In this thread, Sanaa Hashemi gives a summary of her article regarding the India-Taiwan ties, and also at the end, she offers some tips to strengthen the bilateral relations between the two governments.
And that was our episode covering the issue of Saudi Arabia investment in Maldives and how warming of ties between India and Taiwan have angered China. Our team works really hard to make sure that you enjoy the show. We'll meet next week.
To discuss Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the light of the month that we are in, who gave everything for humanity.
For humanity.
My brother Yasir Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode for humanity an episode where we try to find out us as human beings Where can we reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? What are the means for it? And the greatest of means, or one of the greatest of means for us to reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That we are able to reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the sacred sacrifice of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. However, this is not to say that, you know, just Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, you know, like our brothers in faith of other religions who just take a certain personality and say that no belief in this personality is enough for us to get into heaven, it's enough for us to attain the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We do not believe in this type of divinity to a certain level or a particular individual. Yes, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is divine, his movement was divine, but it requires effort on our part to truly understand that movement of the Imam. And again, here we understand that true justice to the Imam and to the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. It's not just that on the 10 days of Muharram we go to the Husseiniyas and weep and we cry and we try to, you know, gain reward by just doing that. Yes, itself is extremely important, there's no doubt about it. But true justice to the movement of the Imam is to try and inculcate the teachings of the Imam in ourselves and then trying to implement them into our society at large. First of all, we start with our families, our bigger families and so on and so forth, our small communities and so on and so forth. But more importantly is this inner revolution, this inward justice that is important that the Imam, you know, elaborated on and showed us that we can do it. And we see this many times on the plains of Karbala on the day of Ashura. Allahumma ja'al mahyaya mahya Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد At a certain point before the Imam even reaches the land of Karbala, he meets a particular person known as Zuhair. Now Zuhair, for example, was not a supporter of the Imam. History books narrate that this person was an enemy of the Imam. He was in the opposite camp. He was a person who believed that the father of the Imam, that is Imam Ali alayhi salam, was responsible for the death of Uthman, the third Khalif. And therefore he was against the Imam. He was not for the Imam. He was an Uthmani, as the history book says. Not Umayyad, there's something else. But he was Uthmani. That he believed that Uthman was murdered, you know, unjustly, or, you know, without proper cause. And the reason for that was because of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and, you know, his supporters. But what happened? The Imam meets him, he asks him, and here we see, you know, another issue that we can see, the impact of the ladies in this movement. Again, as we mentioned, we do not have equality, we have equity. The responsibilities to themselves that they were done and the injustice that were actually done upon them, you know, something that he should be cried about. But again, the reasons for it, the soul of it, needs to be extracted. That the wife of this individual, Zuhair, the impact and the part she plays in the internal revolution and the justice to the soul of this person must not be downplayed. that when the Imam asks to meet him, he refuses. Or he, you know, gives an answer that, you know, shows that, no, I'm not willing to. And his wife then says to him, no, this is the grandson of Rasulullah who is calling you. You have to go to him. You have to answer him. And then he goes at the request of his wife. And in that conversation, no one knows what happened in the conversation. History doesn't record it. But what happened between the Imam and this individual is something for us to ponder upon. That a person who was completely opposite, within a moment, he changed. He changed to become one of the awliya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There are many things that can be discussed here. The capability of the heart of this individual, the soul of this individual. Why was it that his soul was able to be changed where many of the others, even though on the day of Ashura, many times, many of the companions, even the Imam himself, on many occasions spoke to them. Again, this is a form of that justice that the Imam did, that you give a person right up to the last moment the chance to change. This is what the Imam is trying to teach us here, that this is the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives you a chance to come back. And this person, what happened to him? How he changed? What the Imam said to him? Allahu a'lam. Allah knows. But he changed and he became one of those individuals who gave his life for the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And therefore we see that this movement is a movement that, you know, plays on the soul. That we do justice to our souls by this movement. That this movement is the ability for us to take our soul that we have done injustice to. Most of us have, not all of us. Yes, most of us have sinned. Sin itself is injustice to our soul. That when we sin and we break the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that biggest injustice we are doing is to ourselves. We zalam to nafsi. You know, I've wronged myself. I've done injustice to my own soul. I've blackened it. And it is this movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam that hopefully, inshallah, will allow us to do justice to our soul, to bring that soul and put it where it is meant to be put. Where is it? On the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Going towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Following the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and being of those individuals who strive in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Making the law of Allah, making Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala the center of everything that we do. This is what is meant by the justice of the soul. By trying to place the soul back on that path in which it is traveling regardless. It is going, you know, whether we like it or not, inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. You know, to Allah we belong and to Him we shall return. But to place it intentionally on that path of return is something that this mission allows us to do. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that by the right of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, by the right of this mission that Imam did to enable us to truly fulfill our spiritual sides by the light and by the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and not just look at it as a historical event, which again is injustice, but rather an event that enable us to put our soul on the path towards righteousness, towards the path of the Sirat al-Mustaqim, and the path towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hope you have instilled in our heart, in a world where hopes disappear. Peace you have ingrained in our soul, in a time when peace becomes rare. Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave mankind's heart it awaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. God. you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred ring.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.